Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Andre with the throw. Here's Smith behind him to Tobias. Marcus with the jumper. Yes! Ish to KCP. Goes behind the back. Rises and guns. It goes! Marcus wants a screen from Andre. Rises and guns. It goes! Ish with a shot. Sticks it.
It's a great game. You know, Blazers been fighting all year. Teammates did a great job getting the ball to me down the stretch. And, you know, we stayed with it, man. We were down about 12, you know, and we fought back. The bench came in and had a lot of energy. You know, Stanley did a great job on the defensive side. Pope, you know, Ish had like, I think he had like seven steals or something like that. Vince did a great job, and they brought us back in that game.
Just use him in the backup role. Get him out on the floor and get him acclimated to what we're trying to do. It's going to be a process, and you know, but we're looking forward to that process. You know, he's going to have the ball in his hands. You know, Kyle's more off the ball and, you know, working off of screens and getting open. And Darren's going to have to, you know, run the offense and get us in our sets. And he's going to pick up things quickly, which I know he can. Just having him here just to sustain leads when we get leads and, you know, having that veteran leadership on the floor is going to be big for us. And, you know, when you pick up veterans, though, you know, they've been around for a long time, so they can pick up things quick.
KD's left leg, and he had to be taken off the arena, off the floor.
You see that catching right in that knee, locks up and then is forced backward. That's got to be painful.
So you can see very gingerly Kevin Durant leaving the floor here at Verizon Center.
No, I didn't see much. I saw him as I fell, and then I saw his reaction when we were going in transition. And he obviously tried to fight through it. Once he had to call timeout, he knew something was wrong, and waiting to hear what the situation is, and you know, praying he's all right.
We go into that locker room. Usually it's a bustle. It's a small army moving from one place to the other. They're getting dressed. They're hitting the showers. Everybody was sitting at their locker in their jerseys, except for Zaza Pachulia, who was hitting the shower. And they just stewed in that. They just stayed stationary, looked at their phone, nobody talking to each other for probably 10 to 15 minutes. I've never seen that move in this locker room. I didn't see it after Stafford his knee in the playoffs last season, and that was fairly serious. That was the move, and it was not a good one.
You can bet on them to be very cautious. I only have to refer you to what happened in the playoffs last season when Steph Curry hurt himself twice. You know, Steph Curry wanted to come back in that Houston series faster than the team would let him after the slip. And then when he had the second injury in the Portland series, the Warriors kept holding him out and really waited as long as they possibly could. So I think you will see something similar here. You know, they're in reasonably good shape to get the number one seed even without Kevin Durant, but they'll forfeit the number one seed in a heartbeat if they have to, just to make sure that they don't rush Kevin Durant back. They're going to take the long-term view with this, I can promise you that.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Oh my goodness, what a day, what a day, what a day. Thanks for joining us right here in this on this Wednesday afternoon at 11 minutes past 3, first day of the month of March, year of our Lord 2017. Hope you're having a great one. Better day for you, and a better day for me. Better day for Cushlin, better day for Frank, than it was for Kevin Durant last night. Make no mistake about that. Welcome to the Extravaganza. Phone lines are open now at 866-240-1065. They will remain open until about 3:35, at which point we will talk baseball with Anthony Fenech, who covers the Detroit Tigers for the Detroit Free Press. We're going to talk to him from Lakeland as he keeps tabs on the kiddies getting ready for Major League Baseball. Rick Noland, out of Cleveland, will join us to talk about the NBA, not only about the Kevin Durant situation, but obviously about things relative to the Cavaliers out there. They have going to have Deron Williams in uniform tonight as the Cavaliers go to Boston to take on the second-place team in the East. How much time he sees, of course, is only a matter of speculation. We'll find out tonight how ready he is. I can't imagine it'll be a ton of minutes in his first time. I think he's probably only had the one practice now with the Cavaliers since officially joining them. But the other news of the day for the Cavaliers is that Andrew Bogut has committed to joining the Cavaliers and should be with the club by this weekend. So news out of Cleveland. We'll talk to our friend Rick Nolan about that. You just heard some of the montage highlights. The Pistons with a nice win over Portland. You heard a little bit there, Marcus Morris, who had 37 points. And a big debate, by the way, is kind of still underway in Detroit about whether or not Reggie Jackson or Ish Smith should be taking the point at the start of games. How about that? So we'll talk about that a little bit as well. So those are just some of the things that are going on. They all pale in comparison to Kevin Durant. Like I said, we have all had a better day than poor Kevin has had. Kevin Durant, for all of his greatness, you just have to acknowledge this. He has missed a significant amount of games over the course of the last few years of his wonderful career, widely regarded as probably the second best player in the NBA behind LeBron James. Kevin Durant is not necessarily an Iron Man. He finds ways to get himself banged up. And what I mean by that is, you know, he, of course, he had a toe injury that cost him a bunch of games. He had, was it an ankle? I'm trying to remember his exact history that cost him double-digit games in 2015. And then you had the hamstring cost him a handful of games last year. And now he's going to be out probably for the longest time of his career. He's going to be out for at least 4 weeks. Because what we heard from the Golden State Warriors staff and the media department earlier today is that Kevin Durant's knee is going to be reevaluated in 4 weeks. So that's just when they first look at it again. That doesn't mean he's back in 4 weeks. That means we're going to check and see where he is, and then it's going to be probably a little bit of a rehab period after that. There's only 6 weeks left in the regular season. So they're saying he will be back for the playoffs. Does that mean a week or two before the playoffs so that he can get into rhythm with his guys again? Or does it mean when the playoffs begin? To be quite honest, when they talk about a grade 2 MCL sprain, as well as a bone bruise, a tibular is the word that they're using, a tibular bone bruise, truth is, they can't even say for sure he'll be back in 6 weeks. 4 weeks from now, they will reevaluate. And then we'll see where they are. The Warriors could be without their best player. And I know there's a lot of people saying, best player. Steph Curry's the two-time. I don't care. If you've watched the Warriors this year, and I've watched the Warriors as well as we can here in the Eastern time zone to all of those West Coast games. I don't get to see them live all the time, but I follow it enough and read up on it too. You know, Steph Curry is the two-time defending MVP, and he is the only unanimous MVP in league history. But Kevin Durant, the moment he signed with the Golden State Warriors, became the best player in Oakland, California. That's just the fact of the matter. He drives that ship. Great, great talent around him. Steph Curry is obviously extraordinarily unique. And Klay Thompson is tremendous. He's an all-star. Draymond is an all-star. But come on. This is their best player. This is their best player by a lot, in my estimation. And with him being out now for the rest of the regular season, it's going to have an impact. Not just on the NBA Finals, because now you have to ask yourself, are they a lock to win the Western Conference? Are they a lock to come out of the West to face the Cavaliers in a three-match, I like to call it anyway, a three-match in the NBA Finals? I think it is certainly something that is up for discussion and debate. How good are the Warriors going to be without Kevin Durant? Because if you think, well, they'll be just as good as they were last year before they signed him, no, they won't. Because in order to sign him, they had to clear a whole bunch of cap space and roster space. And gone is Harrison Barnes. Gone, as you know, is Andrew Bogut, because he's going to be with the Cavaliers. They are not as deep as they were. Their bench is not as deep. And obviously their scoring punch as a starting unit isn't going to be able to hand a big lead over to that bench as they go because of the absence now of Kevin Durant. Now, they're relieved, according to reports out of Oakland, that the injury wasn't worse. But I can tell you this. I watched it. Kush, did you watch the injury to Kevin Durant happen?
I did not see it live when it happened, but I certainly saw it a little bit late last night, and then I've seen it plenty of times since then.
I have had my own knee hyperextended. I can tell you it is extraordinarily painful. It is a very, very painful thing. And for him to just be standing there like that, with his leg locked, because you're standing there and you don't expect something to come barreling at it from the front, you know, your leg is locked, so you get hit in the knee goes backwards. It bends the other direction, the way it's not supposed to. That's a hyperextended knee. That's what created the grade 2 MCL sprain that they are diagnosing him with. And I'm just telling you, it is very, very painful. And Kevin Durant, with his history of injuries, and I'm not saying he's missed seasons like Joel Embiid, who literally a minute before we came on the air, this story broke. Joel Embiid, who was kind of favored to be the rookie of the year for the breakout season he's having for the 76ers, even though it's his third year because he missed 2 years with injuries. After playing just 31 games, they have decided that Joel Embiid's career is over, or excuse me, season is over. So I don't know if you can give him the rookie of the year after just 31 games out of 82. That's another discussion. Point being, I'm not saying he's as injury prone as that, but Kevin Durant has a hard time staying healthy. He doesn't have that big, thick LeBron James bodybuilder kind of physique. And when you get hit in the knees and you don't have a lot of, big musculature around your ligaments and, you know, your joints and so on and so forth, you are much more susceptible to having things pushed the wrong way, having things kind of knocked out of whack. And Kevin Durant just has a hard time staying. This is a fluke injury. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
It's a fluky thing, but, you know, you hit one guy like that, and it might affect him a little bit differently than other guys. And this is a huge, huge blow for the Warriors. And I don't think it's necessarily a given that they'll have the top seed going into the Western Conference playoffs if they have to play 4 or 5 or 6 weeks without him.
Yeah, and that's one of the first things I was going to touch on. I mean, you know, obviously because Durant goes down last night, they end up losing in Washington. So first random notation, Warriors now have 10 losses, as we all recall. They only had 9 all regular season a year ago. And the separation right now is just 4 games with, just like last year, a Spurs team that feels totally under the radar despite a sparkling record. So it is doable for San Antonio. And with the Warriors also having in this entire time, because it was a couple days ago, they actually formally clinched their playoff spot, earliest, I believe, if I read this correctly, earliest any NBA team's ever clinched a playoff spot.
I think that's right, yes.
There was already starting to be in the periphery the talk of, well, are they going to do a Cavs-style, start resting some of these guys down the stretch kind of thing? And this is where the diagnosis that we heard earlier this morning comes into play. It's 4 weeks to reevaluation, as you pointed out. That's key. That's
what matters.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, they're not even talking about it until a month from now.
Exactly. It's not like, oh, he's going to be back on the court in a month the way that we more or less think that, say, for the Cavs, Kevin Love and or J.R. Smith would be from their various injuries. So they got to reevaluate that. If you're a Golden State, you hope there's a few regular season games left before he's actually, you know, when he's actually able to come back on the court. I don't think he's going to miss, like, the later rounds of the playoffs, but you want to get him back out there in those last couple regular seasons. The same kind of conversation we've been having ever since Love went down. Well, you hope he gets some footing back under in those final regular season games. Same basic principles implied now with the Warriors, and it's going to make them a little bit different of a team, as you pointed out, as we go through this next month, to the point where if they have a couple extra stumbles, yeah, the Spurs could catch him for number one, which honestly is the one thing prior to this injury that I didn't think was going to happen. I was ready to pen in Warriors at 1, Spurs at 2. Let's see if they finally match up this time.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, what's really interesting about this, and I was too, and I think the Spurs are better this year than they were last year, to be 100% honest. Not that they add a lot of pieces, but I think the Spurs are just better at what they do. I think Kawhi Leonard is better now than he was a year ago, and he was already, what, I think fourth in the MVP balloting last year?
Yep.
I think he's better this year. He's a much more refined offensive player. I think that, you know, the interesting part about this is if, while the Cavaliers have kind of been preparing, and we've talked about this, comparing the modern moves that a team like Cleveland makes, they're making with the Warriors in mind, comparing it to how back in the day the Sixers and Celtics used to make moves specifically with each other in mind, not necessarily for, hey, this improves our team against the overall league. It's, no, how do we do in a short series? How does this guy help us in the series against that team?
Yeah.
And they'll make moves based on that. Well, I think Cleveland has been very much doing that for, you know, the better part of, really since the finals last year. And I think the Williams move was made with that in mind. I think the Bogut move is made with that in mind. It would be really interesting if it didn't come to pass. If they have to face the Spurs instead of the Warriors in the NBA Finals, and of course I'm assuming, and you can never really assume in this league, that the Cavaliers don't suffer any more serious injuries. You know, we're sitting here talking about how Durant's injury challenges them. Well, the Cavaliers are in a very similar boat because J.R. Smith isn't supposed to come back until right before the playoffs, just like Durant. Kevin Love is not going to come back until close to the playoff time. And we don't know exactly what kind of shape he is going to be in. When I say shape, I don't mean physically, but you know how condition and how rusty or ready both of those two guys are going to be. But assuming they are, that's, again, just for assumption's sake, and now they suddenly, you know, roll through the playoffs and they get there, and not standing across them are the, you know, 3-point shooting up and down the court, Golden State Warriors, but a much more talented front line, you know, dominated team in the San Antonio Spurs. You know, a LaMarcus Aldridge and Kawhi Leonard team, instead of the Steph and Kevin and the Splash Brothers and the whole nine yards. It might be very, very different. I'm not saying harder or easier, just different, because I think they have been gearing themselves up to face the Warriors for the third straight year in the finals.
And I think you're right on that front, but at the same time, this is why I like the kinds of moves that they have made. And now that it's going to be official, even though you won't see him in a Cavs uniform until probably the weekend, either the at-Miami game on Saturday or the home against Miami on Monday. It'll be one of those two when Bogut makes his debut. But what did I kind of say to you the other day? If you think back to where the Cavs were opening day roster and where they're at now, they've essentially swapped out Mo Williams, Chris Anderson, Mike Dunleavy, and now Jordan McRae, because the word has come out that he's going to be the one waived. He's not even with the team in Boston tonight.
He's done. He's gone. That was official about an hour ago.
And you swapped them out for, again, in no particular order, Kyle Korver, Derek Williams, Darren Williams, and Andrew Bogut. And what I like about that is, even though we all acknowledge that a lot of these moves were to try to match up better with the Warriors, it makes a lot of things stable on the second unit, to the point where you could throw out all sorts of different lineups for various different matchups, you know, in the playoffs. You need a bigger guy for a situation that maybe the Warriors don't do. Well, there's where Bogut is. So even though these moves are in theory to kind of counter the Warriors, the way they've gone about these and the positions these guys are occupying, you can kind of match up against almost anybody.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I'll be honest with you. I think they are stronger just looking at the two positions that matter the most. The backup point guard position that LeBron James was harping about a month ago, and
right,
a lot of people saw it as kind of whining, how much more do you need? Well, you know, there's no doubt it does make a difference. But just looking at the backup point guard and the center position, whether it's off the bench or in a starting lineup type of situation, I like this group better. I'll take the combination of Darren Williams and Andrew Bogut over Matthew Dellavedova and Timofey Mozgov every day of the week and twice on Sunday.
I agree with that.
One is a three-time All-Star, talking about Williams, and at one point, seemingly, you know, a short time ago, and it really wasn't that long ago.
I think his last All-Star appearance was 4 years ago. That's,
I was
really,
going to say,
yeah,
was in the conversation when people would talk about ranking the top point guards.
Sure.
The name Darren Williams was up there when people would say, you know, Lillard or Wall, or, you know, where do you rank, you know, Williams into this whole thing. He was part of that conversation.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, I'm not saying he was the best. I'm not saying he was, you know, above Chris Paul or anything, but he was in that conversation as a three-time All-Star, an explosive scorer, a good playmaker. And that is, I'm sorry, I know scrappy, gritty, gutty, deli did a lot of things that the Cavaliers needed to have done. But Darren Williams is a better player, and I think there's no question that Andrew Bogut is a better, more consistent player than Timofey Mozgov, despite Mozgov's $64 million contract he just got from the LA Lakers in the expanded salary cap signing blitz.
Yeah, and that's very true. And then you think of for Bogut, for example, as well. I mean, especially since the Birdman injury, and he wasn't going to be a big factor, but you still had that bigger body out since he went down with what is, I'm still assuming, is the end of his career, because he's,
yeah,
that
he's
old,
done.
Is now Channing Frye, when he's brought off the bench, and of course I'm speaking the situation with Love is back and all that, you bring Channing Frye off the bench, and he can now once again truly focus on what he was brought in here to do. Be that stretch big guy who can shoot in the long range. He's not a good interior defender, and he only gets some rebounds because, you know, he's a bigger guy. Well, now you have that defense and rebounding off the bench again that you didn't really have from a big guy the way it was constructed beforehand.
Yeah.
So this is part of what I'm saying is how you can match up better with all sorts of opponents, not just the Warriors.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I'm not suggesting that they couldn't beat San Antonio if it came down to that. I'm just saying they would have to refocus.
Yes.
And they would have to re-strategize, drop new game plans, et cetera, because the team was built, I think, to play. And this is the beauty about it, I think, with what they've done. You know, the Warriors are essentially a small three-point shooting team.
Yep.
And they like to get up and down the court, and they don't have a lot of frontline guys, you know, big guys. They can't go big and play a lot of half court other than running guys off screens
really
and winning threes.
They don't really want to in a way. It slows them down.
Yeah, and the Cavaliers are built also to be a three-point shooting team, so they can play that style if they needed to. But then, if they do come up against a team with a big front line, as I've said, a la San Antonio, they are much more prepared, especially with the addition of a guy like Bogut,
exactly,
to be able to handle that. So it'll be really interesting to see how the whole thing plays itself out. Because, again, a lot of guys have to heal between now and the playoffs. Durant's got to heal. He's going to be reevaluated in 4 weeks. You know, we don't know where J.R. Smith is at this point in time. Maybe Rick Nolan could update that for us at 4:05. Exactly how far out is J.R. Smith?
For what it's worth, I did just read a little blurb earlier today that J.R. is at least traveling with the team. Still no formal timetable,
right,
but as we all know.
I'd like to
know,
find out a formal timetable. And
Rick,
see,
I'm sure, will know more than just me reading a blurb.
Or even an informal one. This is like, are we talking, you know, at the you know, middle of March, end of March, first week of April? Like, what exactly are we talking about here? And then same thing with Kevin Love, to see exactly what kind of a track he's on, because a lot of guys have to heal for all of these things to be able to come to fruition anyway. So we're going to talk more about Kevin Durant's injury. We're going to talk more about the Cavaliers. We're going to talk about Pistons' win last night over the Blazers. Very, very nice victory for them. Still not coming consistently enough, in my estimation, for them to really have anything to look forward to in the playoffs if they are to make it into the playoffs. But we will continue to talk about that. More MVP discussions as Russell Westbrook goes off yet again with his 30th triple-double of the season. To put that into perspective, the greatest basketball player ever to lace up sneakers, especially red and black ones, Michael Jordan had 28 triple-doubles in his career. Russell Westbrook has 30 this year. So we're going to get into that a little bit more going on as well. Who is the real MVP? And what does MVP mean? All of that coming up. And coming up directly, Anthony Fenech.
106.5. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
All right. We were supposed to have Anthony Fenech coming on now to talk a little baseball, Tiger style from Lakeland. But the Tigers are in split squad mode today. Anthony is in Lakeland. He is finishing up his gamer on the first one. Or on the one that was there, I should say. So we're going to have him in about an hour. So roughly, don't hold me to the exact time. But we'll have Anthony as soon as he's available in about an hour. Coming up at 4:05, by the way, in a half an hour, we're going to talk NBA with Rick Nolan of the Cavaliers beat writer. Doesn't matter what newspaper, because it's out in Cleveland. Doesn't matter. He's Cavaliers beat writer, though. We're going to talk NBA. The issue, the significance of the Durant injury, its impact on the Cavaliers, if any at all, the impact on the Western Conference race. It is indeed a big deal. Before we do any of that, what do you say we shine a spotlight on the KeyBank High School Athletes of the Week for this week? For the girls, Lake Basketball's Lexi Robinson scored a game-high 26. Oh, you got the music.
Of course I did.
There you go. Attaboy, you remember.
So I wouldn't forget.
Lexi Robinson, I should say, scored a game-high 26 as Lake took out Central Catholic in the sectional final on Friday, 43-37. Lake now takes on Clyde tomorrow night in the district semis. For the boys, Anthony Wayne basketball's Troy Shallots, the senior center, dropped in a game-high 16 along with 9 boards as the Generals beat Southview 76-66 to claim a share of the NLL title. Same two teams going at it again tonight in the sectionals. So there you have it, your KeyBank High School Athletes of the Week for this week. And if you would like to have your athlete nominated and considered for honoring on the radio, please send your nomination to
athlete at 1065theticket.com.
And we will give them great consideration and possibly honor them on the radio. And of course, we will, if you give your name, we'll give you a little shout out as well for nominating your athlete. So,
and
club. Congrats to the congrats to this week's winners.
What's absolutely. And by the way, speaking of sectionals, because it is day two of the sectionals, we're into high school basketball playoff. A little programming note for tonight. There is, we do have a Bill Clark style basketball doubleheader, but due to how our shows go, i.e. it's Wednesday and Mike Miller has Face Off the Hockey Show today, the first game, St. Francis Northview, 6 o'clock on Talk Radio 100.7. Second game of the doubleheader, Southview Anthony Wayne. That'll be about 8 or so right here on the ticket. Had to split it up so we could get everything, and just want everybody to be aware of that.
All right, very good. Thanks very much, Kush, for that update. Okay, I want to get into a couple of different things in this segment as well. I want to get you involved as well at 866-240-1065. Two different quarterbacks have put themselves out there on the market, if you will. Colin Kaepernick, 49ers former 49ers quarterback, because he is opting out of his 49ers deal to hit NFL free agency and see exactly what kind of market value he has. The question of whether he has any market value at all left is a legitimate one. It's a real one. He ended up starting this past season 11 games out of 16. He won one of them. He completed just 59.2% of his passes at just 6.8 yards per attempt. He did throw 16 touchdowns against 4 interceptions. He ran 69 times for 468 yards and 2 more scores. The question of whether or not his production, and it was modest at best, as I just described, his production is worth the massive amounts of baggage. And I'm telling you could probably fill about 4 airplanes with the baggage that this guy is going to bring with him because of his constant social politicking and more. And his lack of production, quite simply, after he had his breakout year under whom? Who helped make Colin Kaepernick Colin Kaepernick? The quarterback whisperer himself, of course. I'm talking about Michigan coach Jim Harbaugh. Ever since he had that breakout year, and he looked like he was just some dynamic force that was redefining the position, he has never, ever found it again. But he is looking to test his wares on the free agent market. I want to compare and contrast him, just briefly, with another quarterback who is looking to get an opportunity to start somewhere else again. And you may have heard of him before. His last name was once Football. And yes, of course, his first name is Johnny. Johnny Manziel, Johnny Football, has re-signed with his agent, Eric Burkhardt, and is ready to attempt his NFL comeback, according to the NFL Network. Manziel made some serious commitments to Burkhardt, per the report, presumably pertaining to his seriousness about football and dealing with his addiction issues. The comeback is real, writes Ian Rappaport. Johnny Manziel has rehired his agent after Burkhardt had him make serious commitments, per Mike Garofalo and me. Not only is Manziel on the comeback trail, but apparently there is serious interest in him from several teams at the NFL Combine this week. Again, according to Rappaport, Johnny Manziel, this is a tweet from about 10:53 this morning. Johnny Manziel, serious enough to get Burkhardt to take him back, is drawing real interest from teams at the Combine, per Mike Garofalo. So he's getting serious interest, despite the fact that there's one massive problem for him. And that problem is, he's got a suspension to serve. Even if he does get signed, nobody could be serious about signing him as a starter. He's going to have to sit anyway for the first 4 games after he signs a contract and does get back into the NFL with a team. The question I have is, and, you know, and Manziel's problems are very, very different than the problems of Colin Kaepernick. Manziel's, they're both self-inflicted wounds, if you will. One of them, through his addiction and his addictive behavior and his commitment to the partying lifestyle, cost him his career. The other one, with just his decision to go all social justice warrior on people after getting engaged to or at least dating a girl who is all very socially political and so on and so forth. And after he started dating her, that's when he started his, hey, I'm going to honor all people of color who face injustice in this country by not standing for the national anthem. And of course, he's made himself a social pariah virtually all across the sport. Virtually, I say. Of course, he does have a few followers and stragglers and hangers on. But he is it's a self-inflicted wound for both of these individuals. Which of them do you think is more likely to draw a decent contract from an NFL team for 2017? That's what I'd like to kind of kick around a little bit at 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065.
Boy, that's a tricky question because, you know, you got issues with either of them. And thinking about it, because I was about to ask, you know, throw out that exact, almost exact same question, Bob, because I find that, you know, fascinating. Out of those two specifically, which one has a better chance of getting a job first?
And by the way, before you answer that, Jim, or continue your commentary before you go to the calls too, what does it say about the state of quarterbacking in the NFL that both of these guys are likely to get contracts somewhere for some amount of money? I mean, it is hard. It is hard, doggone work finding somebody to play quarterback at a very high level, let alone to find two, because you need a competent quality backup in this league because of the injury factor. You know, you can't find 64 high-quality, high-caliber, highly talented, and highly character guys on the face of this planet to play quarterback as a first stringer and a backup for 32 NFL teams. You just can't find them.
Yeah, and to me, the simple, stupid answer to that question is because they're quarterbacks. Doesn't make it right. It just is, you know, it is what it is. They're quarterbacks. They're not running backs or extra wide receivers. They're quarterbacks, and that seems, in this day and age and league, makes them automatically a little more valuable. Thinking about who out of these two specifically, Kaepernick or Manziel, has a better chance to get a job first, for me, it's actually Kaepernick. And for me, the reason I answer it that way is two reasons. One, as you correctly pointed out, social pariah or not, Kaepernick doesn't have a suspension awaiting him. So whether you're a starter or a backup, that's going to, you know, make teams think a little bit more before actually inking that contract. Do I want to bring this guy in knowing no matter what we do with him, he's got to sit?
I think we can eliminate half of that equation, though.
Okay.
I think we can eliminate the starter part. Despite what I just said about, you know, 32 teams, if you look at all of the teams that might be looking to upgrade or start anew at the quarterback position, I don't know that any of them would be desperate enough to say Colin Kaepernick is going to come to our city and start. And I know that none of them are going to say that about Johnny Manziel, given the fact that, of course, A, he has the suspension lingering over him, but also B, because he just sat an entire year out of football.
Yep.
At least Kaepernick was with a club last year, and thus he's going to be in game slash season slash practice mode sort of thing. He's not going to have to basically be starting from scratch the way Manziel is. But neither one of them, I think, are going to be a starter anywhere in 32 seasons.
And that's a very good point. But that last thing you brought up is reason number two why I think it would actually be Kaepernick over Manziel in this kind of question. And that's because, regardless of the social pariah stuff, I think it's clear over their careers that Kaepernick has demonstrated he can play the position better than Manziel. In fact, I'm reminded, Bob, back on Christmas Eve, when the Browns actually got a W, and for a couple hours, you're like, is this going to cost them the number one overall pick? And it didn't. And you know why it didn't? Because of Colin Kaepernick, of all people, led the Niners on a comeback later that afternoon to keep them ahead of the Browns. I distinctly remember that from that actual day.
Yeah, it was his one win the entire season.
Right, exactly. But it's more, not only is it more than Manziel's had this year, but I do think overall in their careers, Kaepernick has had a better career on the field. In other words, out of these two...
Well, he had one season is what he had. Here's the thing. He had one season, and again, it was with Jim Harbaugh, and it was with a very good team, with a very good defense, and he did some things. Manziel, I don't think we have ever even scratched the surface of whatever he can be. I'm not saying his ceiling is Hall of Fame. I'm not saying his ceiling is starter. I don't know, though, because for the very brief time that he was in the NFL, he was constantly drunk or high or something that was prohibiting him from preparing, practicing, studying, gaining the trust of his teammates, getting his timing down with his receivers. There was just no idea whether this guy can play or not.
Yeah.
And that's so, of course, I mean, and by default, Colin Kaepernick wins the, hey, who has shown more? Because, you know, he had the opportunity to shine more. You know, quite frankly, Johnny Manziel is still the same mystery now than he was coming out of Texas A&M.
And that's such an interesting X factor that you point out in this exact kind of question, because to a degree, it is true. No one has really been able to see, truthfully, what he's actually capable of on the field because of X, Y, and Z has kept him more. more or less.
Which is all his fault. Again, all self-inflicted.
Absolutely.
But it is reality. You know, people don't know, and that's why there's going to be, as I said before in the kind of the prefacing of my question, and we'll go to some phone calls now, but as I said in a moment ago, you know, what does it say about the state of quarterbacking?
Yeah.
Brock Osweiler was just handed, you know, what was the contract? What did he get last year? Guaranteed $38 or $39 million guaranteed from...
too much.
to sign with the Texans. Ended up being benched for Tom Savage. And now they're talking about throwing a boatload of money at Tony Romo if the Cowboys release him to bring him to play quarterback for the Texans. Tyrod Taylor in Buffalo is a huge question mark. Whether Blake Bortles has got to be improved upon in Jackson. There
and
just
it was 37
enough.
Million guaranteed for Osweiler. It'll be 16 next year.
There you go. So these guys can't play. There's so many teams that are looking for upgrades that they're going to consider Johnny Manziel. And somebody will probably sign him on a backup basis, probably a minimum contract. And let's see if he can, while sober, if he stays that way, see whether this guy can play. And that somebody is going to take the baggage that comes with Colin Kaepernick and say, let's bring him in and see if he can play. Nobody's going to hand either one of them a starting spot. They bring them in, see what they can do, and then depending on what's in front of them, then see whether or not this is worth the hassle that it's going to be. Let's go to Greg, who's in Toledo. You are on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, we're talking quarterbacks anyway, and you wanted to talk about the Browns QB situation, so let's do it. How you doing?
Okay, well, I haven't talked to you since Thanksgiving. My worst schedule, I haven't listened to in a long time, and we went through the worst season ever. Is the Browns still interested in that guy, Jimmy, from New England, or what do you think they're going to do in this
well, it doesn't matter
quarterback this year?
Yeah, it doesn't matter if they're interested. The Patriots said today, for all intents and purposes, ruled it out and said they are not going to trade Jimmy Garoppolo.
Okay, I had a couple other questions.
Sure.
The Browns have, like, $110 million for money to spend on free agents, and the last couple of years they haven't done it. Do they lose that money if they don't spend it, or what are they going to do this year? Are they going to try to sign free agents or what?
Oh, no, yeah, I think they'll be very active in the free agent market. It's going to be a question of who wants to come there, though. I mean, given the fact that it's just been such a pit of hell for NFL players, you have to overpay their market value and take bigger hits on your salary cap to get guys to want to come there. That's the problem. Because it's just been a place where NFL dreams go to die. It's a place where NFL quarterbacks go to die, that's for sure. You're not going to be able to get any decent free agents to want to come there. So you're going to end up having to draft a quarterback. And you pointed that, you asked a moment ago about quarterbacks, if Garoppolo is going to be part of the solution. And according again to the Patriots today, they are not going to trade Jimmy Garoppolo. So now it comes down to, all right, who's on the free agent market? You know, are the Bears going to cut ties with Jay Cutler? Could you bring a guy like Cutler to Cleveland? I think that would be a disaster for a team that's trying to build a new identity. And he is just, a complete cancer on his own, on every team he's been on. I think they're going to end up having to draft somebody. They're going to end up having to, not with the number one overall pick. I don't believe they'll do that. But I think they're going to look at Deshaun Kizer of Notre Dame, the Central Catholic product, or they're going to look at Deshaun Watson out of Clemson, the national champ, or they're going to look at Mitch Trubisky, the local kid, local to Northeast Ohio there in Mentor, Ohio, who has really, really opened a lot of eyes, has a ton of potential, but only started 13 games there at North Carolina. And I think one of those three guys is probably going to be their pick at number 12.
Are they going to franchise Richard Pryor? What's his name? Pryor,
Richard
wide receiver. wrong Pryor.
Terrell Pryor.
My understanding is no.
They shouldn't. They shouldn't. I'm with you, Jim. I've heard they're not going to do that. I think if they were going to do that, that decision would already have been made and announced. They don't believe, despite his making tremendous progress from his first year as a receiver, you know, not this past season, but the season before to this past season, they cannot see paying him the average of the top five paid wide receivers in the National Football League as required for a franchise guy. That would mean he'd be getting an average salary in the mix of where Antonio Brown, Julio Jones, A.J. Green, and I don't even know who the other top two guys would be. But, you know, he is nowhere near in their class, and they cannot pay $20 million or $19 million or whatever that average is going to be for a Terrell Pryor. He is just not worth it.
You think they're going to trade the first pick, or they're going to keep it? And who do you think they're going to take?
I think they'll keep it, and I think they've decided to go defense. I mean, almost everybody as far as the draft prognosticators and the mocks and everything else say that they're going to take a defensive end with the first pick. But here's the thing. They have, just like they do every year, more holes than they have picks. But last year they had that same mentality that you just said about trading a pick. We had a lot of holes, so let's trade all of our high picks and just get a boatload of twos and threes and fours and fives and sixes. And the problem with that is they took 14 players last year, and none of them were impact players. Now is the time to say enough of the trading. Let's take impact players. Let's take the best player in the draft at number one. Let's take the best quarterback we can find at number two. Now, you know, to most people, Myles Garrett, the defensive end, is the guy who's going to be the number one overall pick, whether it's the Browns or anybody else.
Okay, one last question. They need a center. Will they take that guy who got cut by the Jets who played Ohio State?
I don't see why they wouldn't look at Nick Mangold. That's a very good question. I mean, because Cameron Irving was playing the position for him last year, and he is flat out terrible. I don't think he could play center, guard, or tackle. If he has any position at all, it's got to be left out.
Nice.
Okay.
Thanks all right, my friend. Greg, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Let me move on here real quick and get another one before the top of the hour, and we'll stay in Toledo and say good afternoon to Joe. Hey, Joe, you're on the air. Go right ahead, sir.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Good, my friend. What's on your mind?
The whole Johnny Manziel thing. The guy's a bust. He's a bust. He's even coming out of college, I thought he was a bust. And put aside all the problems he has, he's too small. He's too small. The small quarterbacks, you can get away with that in college. RG3, Johnny Manziel, you know. But once you get to the NFL, everybody's fast, everybody's strong, and you better be a pure passer if you're small. You know, like a Drew Brees.
Right. Well, there are a handful of exceptions to that rule. The most obvious one right now being a guy like Russell Wilson, who's 6 foot, and Manziel is like 5'11 and three quarters. That quarter inch there isn't going to say the difference to make a difference to me. But Wilson
and I agree
is smart.
With you there.
Wilson
yes,
is smart.
Exactly.
He's a game preparer. He knows how to take advantage of his strengths while minimizing the limitations that his height, you know, brings to the table. That's what has made him successful. So it can be done, even if you're, and he's not a pure passer the way Drew Brees is, talking about
Correct.
Russell Wilson.
Correct.
But he knows how to play the game because he prepares to play the game. If Johnny Manziel right. ever dedicated himself to that, which is what I thought in college, after college, I should say, when he came out, I said he can do, I think he could be successful. Now, can he win a Super
yeah,
Bowl?
Yeah, but he doesn't
Wilson
have
did?
A minute
Probably
to
not.
Do that.
But yeah,
he doesn't
have
that
the
in
discipline
him.
To do that. Bingo.
No.
That's exactly.
No,
right.
if you're gonna be that style quarterback, you have to be a Cam Newton where you can absorb those hits and everything else. But being his size, you got to have the dedication and the desire to be the best, and he doesn't have that.
Well, and the other thing you have to do again to kind of tie them together, not only three things, the drive and the dedication and the discipline you're talking about, a la Russell Wilson. The size, if you're going to be a mobile quarterback and get out and run around like Cam Newton to absorb those hits, or going back again now to the preparation part of it. If you study the game and if you learn defenses and you learn how to make your reads early in the drop back as opposed to late because you just don't study, then you can avoid, you know, three quarters of the hits that you would normally take even as a mobile
yes.
guy. Get rid of the
yes.
ball faster, and then when they come after you, they're going to get flagged for it. So,
right.
he's got so many different obstacles there. You know, he can avoid the hits if he just studies the game, and that makes discipline, or I'm sorry, that requires discipline. And I think you and I both agree what we've seen from him so far anyway
yeah.
is he doesn't.
Yeah, he doesn't have that. Yeah. I wouldn't take either one of those guys on my team. Like you say, they just bring any team down, either one
yeah.
of them, him or Kaepernick.
But you know what? But again, somebody will sign him. Somebody will sign
oh,
both
yeah,
of
absolutely.
Them. Even if only in a backup role, somebody will sign him because it's just too hard. I mean, isn't it weird? There's how many? 7.2 billion people on this planet, I think, and they can't find 32 decent starters. It's amazing.
I can't believe they just can't find a backup somewhere that's serviceable. I just can't believe that. You know, and like with the Browns, as far as taking a quarterback, don't even waste your time. You got to when you're rebuilding the team, you build from interior linemen out. You could have Tom Brady back there, and he's not going to do anything for the Browns. He's going to get killed.
Well, that's true. That's true. But you know what? You still have to find the quarterback. And here's the other thing.
Yeah, but
a really good quarterback.
To find one now.
A really good quarterback can also make you know, some of the other areas that are deficient look a little bit better, again, by faster decision-making, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not saying that you take a quarterback and then just grab scrap players, but the Browns have so much money under the cap, they can spend a lot in free agency. If they can entice, a couple of good linemen to join them, or if they can make the right hit, like I think they did with Betonio. He was a great selection 2 years ago at guard. But they let Mitchell Schwartz go, and they let Alex Mack go in free agency, and that's why they're sitting there struggling. But you know what? You've seen it yourself. You cannot win in this league unless you have an elite quarterback. And until they find one, they're going to be spinning their wheels.
Yeah, well, they still have to protect him. Like I say, take that pick, trade him away for the best offensive lineman you can get, and start there.
Well, and you know what? That may be an option. You know, I would not rule that out. I don't think they're going to trade that pick away for like two third rounders and some scrap heap. They're going to have to take a high pick, take a player with a high pick that is an impact player. And if it's an offensive lineman, like you're suggesting, move down a little bit and add something else and take a great offensive lineman, fine. But then with that number 12 pick, I firmly believe, I'll say it again, you have to find your quarterback.
Yeah, I agree. You do have to have one, but like I say, the Browns are just so far away from a quarterback.
Yeah. No,
right
they
now.
Are. Yeah, they are. And thanks for the call. I got to run, Joe. Great call. Great conversation. I really enjoyed it. Truth is, they've been without a quarterback though longer than they've been without offensive linemen. They've been without a quarterback since 1999. If I was Prince, I would have sung that. But it's been seriously that bad since they came back as a franchise. They have not had a decent starting quarterback. Well, of any length whatsoever. All right, going to get a timeout here at the top of the hour. Sports Center coming your way. And after that, we're going to talk a little bit of basketball. How badly does Kevin Durant's injury change the landscape in the West? And what does it mean to the contenders in the East, like the Cavaliers, for example? So we're getting into all of that with our friend Rick Nolan coming up.
Reggie lobs. Andre with the throw. Here's Smith behind him to Tobias. Marcus with the jumper. Yes! Ish to KCP. Goes behind the back. Rises and guns. It goes! Marcus wants a screen from Andre. Rises and guns. It goes! Ish with a shot. Sticks it.
It's a great game. You know, Blazers been fighting all year. Teammates did a great job getting the ball to me down the stretch. And, you know, we stayed with it, man. We were down about 12, you know, and we fought back. The bench came in and had a lot of energy. You know, Stanley did a great job on the defensive side. Pope, you know, Ish had like, I think he had like 7 steals or something like that. Bench did a great job, and they brought us back in that game.
Just use him in the backup role. Gave him out on the floor and get acclimated to what we're trying to do. It's going to be a process, and but we're looking forward to that process. You know, he's going to have the ball in his hands. You know, Kyle's more off the ball and, you know, working off of screens and getting open. And Darren's going to have to, you know, run the offense and get in our sets. And he's going to pick up things quickly, which I know he can. Just having him here just to sustain leads when we get leads and, you know, having that veteran leadership on the floor is going to be big for us. And, you know, when you pick up veterans, though, you know, they've been around for a long time, so they can pick up things quick.
KD's left leg, and he had to be taken off the arena, off the floor.
You see that Ketsey right in that knee locks up and then is forced backward. That's got to be painful.
You can see very gingerly Kevin Durant leaving the floor here at Verizon Center.
No, I didn't see much. I saw him as I fell, and then I saw his reaction when we were going in transition. He obviously tried to fight through it. Once he had to call timeout, he knew something was wrong, and waiting to hear what the situation is, and praying he's all right.
We go into that locker room. Usually it's a bustle. It's a small army moving from one place to the other. They're getting dressed. They're hitting the showers. Everybody was sitting at their locker in their jerseys, except for Zaza Pachulia, who was hitting the shower. And they just stewed in that. They just stayed stationary, looked at their phone. Nobody talking to each other for probably 10 to 15 minutes. I've never seen that move from this locker room. I didn't see it after Stafford, his knee in the playoffs last season, and that looked fairly serious. That was the move, and it was not a good one.
You can bet on them to be very cautious. I only have to refer you to what happened in the playoffs last season when Steph Curry hurt himself twice. You know, Steph Curry wanted to come back in that Houston series faster than the team would let him after the slip. And then when he had the second injury in the Portland series, the Warriors kept holding him out and really waited as long as they possibly could. So I think you'll see something similar here. You know, they're in reasonably good shape to get the number one seed even without Kevin Durant, but they'll forfeit the number one seed in a heartbeat if they have to, just to make sure that they don't rush Kevin Durant back. They're going to take the long term view with this, I can promise you that.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Hour number two is underway. We begin at 4:13, and it was a freak accident. Make no mistake about it. It was a freaky thing. I don't know too many guys who could have avoided having their leg buckle, having their knee bend backwards, which is what a hyperextension is, when you get it slammed into by a guy as big as Zaza Pachulia. Having said that, freaky accident or not, it's a significant one because it's going to last at least 4 weeks. That's when they'll reevaluate him. That doesn't mean he comes off of the injured list and is ready to go. They'll evaluate him then. They may say, takes two more. They may say it takes one more. They may say he's ready to go in 3 days. Nobody knows, but it's going to be a significant factor, as you just heard in some of the montage comments, on who wins the West. Joining us now to break down the Kevin Durant breakdown and a little bit of activity on the Cleveland Cavaliers roster is our good friend Cavaliers beat writer Rick Nolan, joining us now on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Hey, Rick, how are you?
I'm doing well, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. Boy, I'll tell you what, you know, I was pondering this a little bit earlier today, Rick Nolan, about these teams that we just assume can't be beat. And I think everybody coming into the season assumed that the Cavaliers couldn't be beaten in the East and that the Warriors couldn't be beaten in the West. And I'm not saying the Cavaliers will be beaten, but you don't factor in things like J.R. Smith breaking a finger or a thumb or whatever it is on his shooting hand and being out most of the season. You don't factor Kevin Love going down again for a month or more and coming back just before the playoffs. You don't factor Kevin Durant, you know, the four-time scoring champion and one-time MVP who joined the best team in basketball in the regular season a year ago with 73 wins and making them almost unbeatable. You don't factor him going down at this time either. How significant of an impact do you think this injury has on what everybody expected, which would be a Cavaliers-Warriors three match in the finals?
Well, I mean, it's a great unknown. I'm a little... I kind of think it's more serious than they're letting on, is my initial gut instinct. The fact that it's going to take 4 weeks and then they're going to evaluate it again. I don't know what that means, because if either something's torn or something's not, my hunch is that maybe they think it's not. I mean, they did an MRI. They should know these things. There's a chance, Bob, in my mind that he may not play in the playoffs at all.
Really?
I'm only saying that by trying to read between the lines and make 2 and 2 equal 222. But the fact he's out a minimum of 4 weeks and then we'll evaluate him again, that kind of throws me for a loop. Is it possible that he might decide he needs surgery in 4 weeks? Or if not, why isn't he just going to be able to play?
I'm not a doc. I'm not a doc, obviously, neither are you, Rick, but I don't know that I've ever heard of surgery for a sprain. A sprain has never required surgical repair. A tear would, a partial tear or a full tear of the MCL, or any other L, for that matter. You tear a ligament, you're going to have surgery. You sprain one, it's a matter of time and rehab and re-strengthening around that. That's why I don't think it's going to be as serious as surgery, but I just think they wonder how fast it's going to heal, and that's why they're saying we're going to reevaluate this in a month.
Possible. I for whatever reason on this one, am skeptical. I hope you're right, because I want to see these two teams, being Cleveland and Golden State, I want to see them both at close to full strength, and have a potentially another finals for the ages, a 7-game series. I don't want anybody winning it with the other team having significant guys not playing. So hopefully
you mean like Golden State did 2 years ago the first time?
Exactly. Yes. I want to see KD play. I want to see JR and Kevin Love be back at full strength and just let them duke it out and may the better team win. I really want to see that. And
Kevin Love is on my mind. Rick Nolan, let's talk about the what ifs. Let's suppose you're correct and that Kevin Durant is not going to be back. Or even let's just say he does come back, but just barely in time for the playoffs. I'm just looking at the rest of their 6 weeks of the regular season left. They got, 22, 23 games, something like that left.
Right.
Is there a chance they lose that top seed? Is there a chance they lose their favorite status to the Spurs, who are only, what, three or four games behind them anyway as it is? How good are the Warriors as constructed minus Kevin Durant? Now, they're going to pick up Matt Barnes to fill that roster spot, and he'll come in and do some things to help them out a little bit. Obviously, nowhere near what Kevin Durant does, but that's, you know, that's the best-case scenario for them, or the best way they can handle this situation. But if they don't have Kevin Durant, they still have the Splash Brothers. They still have Draymond Green. They still have, you know, a little bit of size with Pachulia. They're not as deep without Harrison Barnes, without Andrew Bogut, as they were a year ago. But can they still, or would do you think they still be the team to beat in the West?
Yes, and I was going to ask you, I don't even know what their lead is in the West, because it was always such a foregone conclusion in my mind that they were going to be number one. I honestly quit paying a whole lot of attention to it.
I want to say it's four, but hold on a second. Let me look. Yeah, I was correct. It's four. They're 50-10.
Okay.
The Spurs are 45-13. So it's a four-game essential game lead over the Spurs.
And the Spurs are likely to sit guys here and there too over the next month and a half. You know, we thought the same thing about the Cavs, or wondered the same thing about them. You know, 2-3 weeks ago when Kevin Love went out, would they be able to hold on to the number one seed, and they haven't lost any ground at all.
Yeah, their lead is also four, by the way.
So, in fact, they've expanded their lead, actually, then, since he's left. So, in the East, of course, there just nobody really seems to want to make a serious run at it. Boston's going to be two, I think, when all's said and done. But San Antonio, I don't think they're gonna play guys so much, so hard every night, just to make a run at one. I think they'd rather be rested and healthy. Quite honestly, I think Golden State would too if it came right down to it. But you know, this is a team.
Who wins a hypothetical Western Conference final, though? A KD-less Warriors or
against
the Spurs?
San Antonio?
Yeah,
that's you know, that one's tough. That's a lot tougher to call.
I think the Spurs are better this year. Not better than the Warriors. I mean, they're better than they were a year ago. And we all know they had one of the all-time great single-season records in history last year. It was swamped by the 73-win Warriors, so nobody paid attention. But the Spurs were a tremendous team last year, and I think they're better this year, if only because I think their best players got better. I think Kawhi Leonard is a much better player than he was last year. And last year he was fourth in the MVP voting. I just see this team as getting better, not worse. You know, especially with the retirement of Tim Duncan, they lose a little bit of the age off of this thing, and they're just kind of retooling it and fine tuning it. But I think they're getting better, and I think that's a really, really, really tough series for the Warriors if Durant is not there.
And now, you know, that series might be when we get the first glimpse at just some of the depth that Golden State lost by acquiring Kevin Durant is not there. You know, they don't have a Bogut. They don't have a Harrison Barnes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not going to suddenly become a 500 team without KD, but, and they still have, you know, three really, really good players, and the other all-stars, but they're not the 10 deep team they were the last 2 years pre-KD. So basically what you have now, I guess to make it real simple, is the same star players as they had last year, minus some of the quality depth and role players they had last year. And they struggled to win a few series last year.
Yes, they did. They had to come back from 3-1 to KD and Russell Westbrook and the Thunder, as we all
recall. Right, with better players. Only time will tell. That could be a drag out series, and quite frankly, I think there's a lot of people in Northeastern Ohio hoping it is, and they beat the heck out of one another, and whoever survives is worn out, and the Cavs repeat as champions.
I talked in the first hour, Rick, about this, and I want to get your thoughts on it. Rick Nolan is our guest. He covers the NBA and the Cavaliers out in Cleveland. The Cavaliers have kind of been adding to the roster. How about that? Rounding things out. I think essentially to combat the Warriors in the finals. I don't think they worry about anybody in the Eastern Conference. I don't think it's any secret. They kind of make decisions based on how will it work out in a seven-game series against the Warriors. In the same way that back in the early 80s, you know, the Sixers and Celtics made moves specifically for one another. They didn't really care about anybody else in the conference. How do we beat them in a series? Let's get this guy to stop that guy. So anyway, that's kind of what they've been doing. How much of a loop will it throw them for, if any at all, if they get there and, hey, lo and behold, it isn't the Warriors. It's the Spurs, a team that, you know, Greg Popovich has for the better part of LeBron's career, found a way to beat him. And in part because he just had better players around, you know, working for him than LeBron had with him. But by and large, you know, the San Antonio Spurs have been a very, very tough out for LeBron James, both in Miami and in Cleveland. Would it be a real difficult change or challenge for them if they don't get the team that they've kind of been maybe mentally and roster-wise shaping themselves for, if it's somebody else in the finals?
I don't think it's going to be nearly the issue that you might think, because I think what they did since January with adding Korver, Deron Williams, Derek Williams, and Bogut, they basically got four quality players for virtually nothing, quite honestly. At least nothing that was going to play for them in a playoff series. But they have some enormous flexibility off their bench right now, almost to the point where it's going to be extremely crucial that Ty Lue makes the right decisions on who plays and who doesn't, because it's entirely possible that Channing Frye doesn't play much in the postseason. It's entirely possible that Iman Shumpert doesn't play much. Bogut plays if they play a team like Washington or Toronto that has a legitimate big. But otherwise, you know, he's going to be a piece as part. So it could change series to series. And I don't know how much, Bob, that Bogut was going to play against Golden State in the finals anyway. I think that was a Derek Williams acquisition there. It's an athletic body that kind of matches up with their small lineup. So I think they're pretty well equipped regardless of who they play, provided that they can settle on who they should be using. Mm-hmm. And, Ty Lue, sometimes it's harder to coach when you have a ton of options. Than when you David Blatt was never a better coach than when he had very few choices to make in the 15 finals, and just kind of said, here, you guys are playing 40 minutes, get out there and get it done, you're all we have. So Ty's going to have, you know, legitimately 10 to 11 guys to choose from, and rotations generally get shorter in the playoffs, not longer. So
yep.
I think the good thing is, not to get long-winded, is they have true professional players who understand this and, you know they might play one series and may not play the next. But it's what they signed up for when they came here with the chance to win that ring.
No question about it, and I'm sure they do all understand that, being the professionals they are. Rick Nolan joining us, talking about the NBA. So let's talk about these two new additions. Deron Williams is going to be in the lineup, not in the lineup necessarily, but he's going to be on the court in uniform tonight. He'll play probably limited number of minutes in his debut. Andrew Bogut expected to join the team, if I heard correctly, by the weekend. How much do they change and improve this roster?
Well, Deron, I think he's a regular season improvement guy in my mind, in that he allows LeBron possibly to sit out a game or two because they now have another playmaker besides Kyrie. Yeah. No, actually, I mean LeBron to sit out.
So he would play alongside Kyrie?
Well, no. He would be a playmaker when Kyrie wasn't on the floor.
Oh, I see. So whereas LeBron does that when Kyrie is down. Okay, I got you.
Right.
So
they feel when LeBron doesn't play and Kyrie goes out of the game pre-Deron Williams, they have virtually nothing out there that can create any offense. So now, regardless of which player, Kyrie or LeBron, sits out a game, Deron would at least be able to pick up the slack for the one that does play when he's out. He's still a quality player
That's what I was going to ask you. How much do you think he still has in him of the Darren Williams that was an All-Star as recently as 4 years ago? He's a three-time All-Star. And I was telling Jim earlier in the show, it wasn't that long ago, you know, like 4 years ago, maybe five, I suppose, that we were talking when we would do the whole, hey, who's the best point guard in the NBA thing? Yes. His name was in the conversation in that top five, six guys.
Absolutely. I don't think he's that player by any stretch of the imagination. He's 32. I don't think he's done, though. He could still play he could still start for, 10 or 15 teams in this league. Cleveland's not going to be one of them, but, point guards tend to go quickly when they go. I don't think he's reached that stage yet, but he's not, he's never been a super quick point guard. He's kind of more of a strength point guard.
Right.
A guy that can withstand a little contact, who can jostle a little bit, who can also actually play a little shooting guard if you really need him to. Extremely good running the pick and roll. That's been one of his strengths since he came into the league. We'll have to see defensively. I quite honestly didn't watch him real closely at Dallas, but from what I have heard, that area was never phenomenal to begin with, but it's probably slipped a little more even than that in the last couple of years. But he gives them a guy who can make shots, who can run an offense, who knows how to play the game. I think for what it cost, which was nothing, I don't think they could have done better for getting LeBron his playmaking point guard than they did.
Yeah, and it's weird that he wasn't even on anybody's radar when we all talked about, who's available as a playmaking point guard backup. We talked about Chalmers and Norris Cole and
right.
various other people.
Right.
We never talked about guys on active rosters that might be traded and released or bought out, as in the case with Bogut as well. So really, Griffin and the entire front office have done just masterful work at reading the tea leaves, figuring out what might be available, not pulling the trigger too early, especially a month ago. It's been about a month now ago,
right.
Maybe even a little longer, that LeBron started publicly airing his grievances, a la Festivus, about all of the things that they're lacking. And, and rather than saying, okay, LeBron, we'll get you somebody right away, they had the patience to wait this thing out through the deadline to see, what the best thing to do was. And I think you're right. This is the best available option. And I think Bogut is a huge, huge get as well. If not just because of the big rim protector that he can be in given circumstances and situations, also because of his knowledge of virtually everything that the Golden State Warriors do inside and out. He was with them for both of their finals teams.
Yeah, I think, to generalize, I view him as kind of a flip version of Darren Williams. May not be tremendously important in the regular season, but I think there will be times in the postseason where he'll be able to have a truly big impact, depending on who they're playing and what the matchups are. But the games tend to slow down. It's important to challenge shots. It's important to limit shots. And even though he hasn't played much this season, he still puts up a really, really good rebounding number. Given the low amount of minutes he plays, I think he's averaging 8 this year in, if I'm not mistaken, less right around 20 minutes in the games he's played. But, both those guys are 32, and it seems like they are 36 because I followed their careers so long, but they're still on the very, very end of their prime. They're probably in the beginning of their twilight years, which can go on for 3 or 4 years. I've always loved Bogut because I think he's a selfless player who is not tremendously awesome at any one area, but he can pass. He's a good finisher off of lobs. He's a really intelligent team defender, not just blocking shots at the rim, but switching on high pick and rolls temporarily to a guard recovers, just in kind of calling out where everyone is for teammates. I've always liked his game, like a lot of high picks, like Derek Williams. It took a while to get over the fact that he was a number one overall pick in the 2005 draft, and just kind of appreciate what he could do. rather than to compare him to, you know, Hall of Fame number one picks in the draft of previous years. He's had a solid career. He's a guy that can find ways to help a team. They might not always show up real big in a box score, but I think the Cavs will really enjoy having him around because, I mean, he's a winning player who does things that help you win.
Yeah, no question about that, and that is very important. Hey, real quick, Rick, just to bring it to tonight, at Boston, the number two team in the East, obviously, a lot of people wonder whether Boston would try to really make a run at them by getting a Butler or a Paul George or somebody. Did not work out that way, and but they're still a pretty talented team, and they certainly give the Cavaliers everything that they want. Is this one of those proverbial statement games now that we're about, like I said, 20, 22, 23 games left in the season? How badly does Boston really need to beat Cleveland tonight?
Well, I don't know that a win or a loss by either team is going to change the way anyone views the Eastern Conference. I'm certainly not going to think Boston is better than Cleveland if they win tonight. I think the only thing of real importance is that if Boston has any hope of winning the East, they need to win a game like this because you know you don't want to drop another one. Behind. I think what we'll also see real quick, too, it's going to be interesting to watch. We'll know how much Darren Williams has left in the tank defensively. First time we see him go up against Isaiah Thomas, who not many people in this league can keep in front of them. But
no question.
That's a really it's a really tough guy to make your team debut against. So they may actually look for every opportunity to avoid that matchup and possibly have Shumpert play with him and defend Isaiah if he's on the floor so Darren can guard somebody else. Because at 32, I slipping defensively or not, even if you're at the top of your game defensively at 32, you're going to have a hard time keeping Isaiah in front of you, so
no question.
And Kyrie, quite frankly, can't keep him in front of him either. So
that's exactly right. And
24, that's 32, or 34. Yeah, nobody does. So
that's another reason it's going to be so important to get J.R. Smith back because he's a better on the ball defender than either one of those guys. Not that
Absolutely.
He'd just necessarily be that guy on a full time basis, but can certainly help, especially in given situations. Try to, as you say, at least keep that guy in front of him. Rick Nolan, we got to run. I really appreciate the breakdown and the analysis. Thanks so much for the time. Enjoy the game tonight, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Rick Nolan joining us, talking a little NBA, Kevin Durant's injury, what impact it might have. Going to take a timeout now, but on the way into this timeout and this sports center, we're going to hook you up with a pair of tickets to see the Impractical Jokers at the Toledo Zoo coming up on July 6th. Tickets go on sale this Friday at 10 a.m. That makes this a Beat the Box Office contest. So you can beat the box office by being caller number 8 right now to 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. Go see the Jokers at the Zoo on July 6th, courtesy of your friends here at ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Back after this.
The Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
We are indeed back. It's 4:43. Time to shift gears a little bit, away from the NBA and into Major League Baseball. Let's head down to Lakeland, Florida, and catch up with our good friend Anthony Fenick, who covers the Detroit Tigers for the Detroit Free Press. Anthony, how you doing, my friend?
Good, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. Good to talk to you. Did you ever figure out who the cat was who hit the ball out of the park?
Yes, it was. His name was Rowdy Reed.
Rowdy Reed's a bat flipper, huh?
Raudyreed.
Oh, Rowdy Reed.
A bat flipper. Rowdy Reed.
Rowdy getting rowdy at the. I was following you on Twitter and I saw that and I thought that's interesting. We got to figure out who it is. Now, when you say out of the ballpark, I mean, well, what kind of a shot are we talking about? Do we have an estimated distance?
There was no estimated distance, but there's a big berm in left field and it went over it. It went out of the ballpark.
Wow. So that must have been interesting and kind of
fun.
There
were two today. Michael A. Taylor also hit one out of the ballpark.
Really? Okay, so some guys are banging it out there. Not a very good guy. I mean, I'm looking at your tweet from a half an hour ago of the Tigers' 5 grapefruit games so far. This was by far the worst. Nationals 9-1. What are you seeing?
It was a bad game to watch, as most of these grapefruit league games are bad games to watch. You know, Mike Pelfrey started, and he's pretty much going to be destined for relief, I believe, long relief. He started, he wasn't all that sharp. He was kind of tinkering with a few things, more specifically a cutter that he was unable to throw for strikes. Mm-hmm. So on that end, it wasn't that good. But, I mean, again, it's a grapefruit league start. I don't think you can read too much into it, even if Pelfrey struggled. I think the one thing that was probably most alarming, I'd say, was, and again, it's hard to be alarmed with velocity and stuff this early. It was his first action, really, but he was at 90, 91 on the radar gun, whereas last year he was like 93, 94. So that could be something to watch. Overall,
at the same time last year, Anthony, 93, 94 at the same time last year?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I don't know if it was exactly the first start, but in spring he was definitely, you know, 93, 94. And even in mid-season point, before he got hurt, he was 95, 96 even.
So the 91, I'm sorry to belabor the point, but so the 91 you're talking about, which could be something to watch, it could also just be ramping it up. You know, he's not cutting loose yet. It's his first start, and he's really kind of gearing up, right?
Yes. Tigers offensively haven't done much, but again, it's kind of early in the spring slate still, unfortunately.
Yeah, no question about that. So let's talk about some of the pitchers, though. Jordan Zimmermann was very strong in his first outing, and Anibal Sanchez not so much. Is it just doesn't matter in either case? You look good, doesn't matter. This is where we are. You look bad, doesn't matter. This is where we are. How does Ausmus approach it, and how do you approach that?
No, I think Zimmerman's good is a more good for the team, I guess, just because he had been kind of the X factor, the guy that the Tigers really wanted to see come in and pitch healthy. And so far he looks healthy. I mean, I think it's the questions aren't going to go away, though. I mean, this is a guy that up until last year he wasn't ever really hurt, but he was hurt last year. He looks good, though, especially, you know, catcher Alex Avila. He was really complimentary of Zimmerman. But with Sanchez, I mean, I don't think there's really any positives you can take from it. It's hard to say. You know, it's just a bad start because, I mean, to me, and I wrote this in the Free Press, the thing about Sanchez is the way he sounded after. He sounded very similar to the way he had in years past where it's like, I don't know what's going on. I don't have any answers. And he just sounds like his confidence is taking a hit to the point where he had a good offseason, he felt, and he was kind of hoping to get some more velocity on the fastball, but that hasn't come. And he just looks a little bit defeated out there. And I know it's one inning. Or inning and a half, whatever it was, and it's in the Grapefruit League, but it just, that wasn't a good sign because he simply put, did not look like a pitcher that the Tigers could hold in the starting rotation or in the bullpen with the way he pitched.
Yeah, it says it was just the one inning, and I'm looking at your colleague's piece on this from the Detroit News, your colleague from the other paper anyway, Lynn Henning, who says
My competitor.
Okay, there you go.
Competitor. Well, you're on the interview with me, but no, I'm just kidding.
Colleague in journalism, how about that is what I mean to say.
Yeah.
But she points out that that he's on notice and that Brad Ausmus is not mincing words. It's very matter of fact, not the results you want, just one outing, yes, but we'll see how it progresses. She says he's on notice, and he is not a guarantee, obviously, to make this team, because isn't he going to make around $16-17 million this year?
Yeah, 16.8, and then if you add the $5 million for the buyout next year, assuming they don't pick up the $16 million option, which seems about 99.9% unlikely, it's really $21.8 million Tigers still owe Sanchez.
Wow. So I mean, obviously, and then they can buy him out. They can buy him out if this does not work out. So I mean, from what you're saying, This is a make or break time for him, and he looks broken. Even just one start in, or at least the reaction to his bad start, one start in, doesn't really give you a reason for optimism.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, it ultimately isn't going to be Brad Austin's call. I mean, that's when you're talking about $16.8 million, you're talking about, you know, that's a front office kind of call. And again, there's still a lot of spring to go, but the pitcher we saw there isn't a pitcher that you can just say, okay, we'll throw him in the bullpen, because in the bullpen, he wasn't looking any better. He showed some signs, some spurts last season out of the bullpen, but it's been
too consistently. He's shown diminished stuff and just not having the ability to kind of fight through that, so to speak, or to adapt and kind of counter that decline in fastball.
Is there anybody in the lineup that you can point to that you like, or who's taking good swings right now, having good at bats, whether it be today or the last couple of, you know what, we're in fire. This is preseason game or spring training game number 5. Anybody that you like how they're swinging it right now that we should be take note of?
Yeah, a couple guys. Nick Castellanos keeps hitting, and he's translating the power from the batting practice field where he was going opposite field. He was really impressive. Maybe most impressive has been Castellanos on the bases. You know, Ausmus thinks he's gotten faster. Tigers coaches have been saying that throughout the season, which kind of, to me, points well to him hitting second. Dixon Machado, too. Dixon Machado's hit pretty well. He went 3-for-3 about an hour away in Dunedin. I think this is a guy the Tigers are really planning on keeping. He's out of options, so he'll be exposed to waivers if he doesn't make the team. I think they're going to find a spot for him in the team so they don't lose him. So those two guys would be Castellanos because I think he's in for another breakout season.
Okay.
And Machado because they want to keep him around.
I like it. Good stuff, Anthony Fenech. Keep up the great work for the Free Press, obviously, and I know you're a busy guy. Thanks for squeezing us in for a few minutes to talk Tigers baseball.
Absolutely, Bob. Thanks a lot. I appreciate this.
You got it, brother. Have a good one. There you go. Anthony Fenech joining us from the Detroit Free Press. He does an outstanding job, whether he's talking to us or whether he's writing and covering these games. This is a very fun guy to talk to. I'm looking at the Sanchez thing. And again, I don't want to read too much into it any more than anybody else does. And Anthony put it, you know, very well, you know, though, that the guy doesn't look like, hey, it's okay. I'm working on a couple of things. No big deal. He looks really very frustrated, talking about Anibal Sanchez and how he doesn't have any answers for what he did. Quoting from Anthony's article, I don't know, when asked about the results. I don't know. Watch the videos. I don't know what's going on. Now, he allowed all singles, but most of them were very hard hit, not little seeing eye singles or bloops or anything else. But he did not record an out until the 24th pitch of his one inning. And his fastball was in the 89 to 91 range, according to one of the scouts in attendance. And his changeup was the best pitch of the end. He threw 20 pitches, allowed 3 runs, great stop by Castellanos. And again, I was quoting from Anthony Fenech's article here. Great stop by Castellanos, dove to his backhand to assist on the final out of the third inning. He could have been pulled without escaping the inning. Yeah, if he had not made that big play, basically he could have been yanked without even escaping the inning. So anyway, Anibal Sanchez celebrated his 33rd birthday and not exactly in the best position that he's ever and this was actually about yesterday's game, the best position that he's ever been in a spring training. All right, so there's just a little bit of an update. Tigers are kind of scuffling through spring training thus far, not getting a lot of great performances. Obviously, as Anthony pointed out, their loss 9-1 to the Nationals was by far the worst. Nothing really looked very good. But I will do what Anibal Sanchez would not do and just kind of dismiss a lot of this as very, very early baseball. And, you know, the first couple of outings, you're only going an inning or two, maybe 3, depending on who you are and what your timetable is. It's just not too terribly much to get worried about. What I do find interesting, going back to the Detroit News, the competitor, as Anthony reminded me, not colleague, but competitor, there was an interesting article about the Tigers and what the national expectations are. And according to the odds makers, the expectations are for the Tigers to be about an 82-win team. So in other words, just a shade over 500. They won 86 games last year. Odds makers are saying not so much this year. Tigers win total at 80. This is Bovada saying the Tigers win total will be 82.5, 13th among all major league teams, and about 10 victories shy of the American League Central Division champions, which is predicted to be the Indians. The world champion Cubs own the largest win total expected by the odds makers at 95.5. Padres are last at 66.5. If you're just wondering specifically about the American League Central, it looks like they have the Indians winning the division with 92.5 wins. And I don't know why they do these half things. Indians winning the division at 92.5. The Tigers would be second at 82.5. Then checking in, they don't have them in the divisional order here, so bear with me. Then come the Royals at 76.5. followed by the Twins at 74.5, and the White Sox bringing up the basement at 69.5. So that's just a little early oddsmakers prediction of the baseball. We haven't even begun really in-depth baseball coverage yet on this program. We've just kind of checked in with Zach Meisel from Goodyear, Arizona, where the Indians reside from time to time. We'll check with Fennec from Lakeland from time to time. As we get deeper into March, obviously, and closer toward baseball's opening day, we will have much, much more for you and get a lot of opportunities for you to get in as well. All right, a couple of final notes here because we are running short on time, and we do have drive time coming your way with Mike Miller at 5 o'clock. Just a couple of other notes, things that are going on. The Cavs' Deron Williams is going to be in uniform tonight, according to reports out of Cleveland at Boston, who is, of course, their chief rival, standings-wise anyway, in the Eastern Conference. Boston comes into tonight's game 4 games back of the Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference. Certainly important to not let them get too close and talk about possibly overtaking the Cavs. They don't want to be on the road if they have to play in the Eastern Conference Finals. They don't want to be in Boston for the first 2 games and having to deal with that nonsense. So I think tonight's game is more important than maybe some people might let on. Deron Williams will be in uniform. Andrew Bogut, who has not yet officially signed, is expected to sign and join the team by the weekend. I mentioned this in ever so brief moments in the first hour of the program. Really interesting debate between Russell Westbrook and James Harden, and it seems to be a new debate every night, every time one of them does something spectacular. And last night, Russell Westbrook was spectacular. He scored the final 12 points. Or no, let me rephrase. He scored 12 points in the final 2 minutes and 6 seconds last night to secure a win, 43 points, 11 rebounds, 11 assists, another double-double, his 30th of the season. Russell Westbrook's 30th double-double of the season. And for comparison's sake, Michael Jordan had 28 of those in his career. Now, it wasn't something anybody pursued back then. If it just happened, it happened. Clearly, Russell Westbrook is pursuing that. And that's fine. And he's doing a tremendous job of it. So is Harden, though. Harden is 28.8 points per game and 11.3 assists per game and 8.1 rebounds per game playing the point guard. I know he's listed as a shooting guard, but essentially he runs the offense. He is the point guard. Westbrook, for his purposes, 31.2, 10.3, and 10.6 points per game, or rebounds per game. He is averaging a triple-double. One of them must be. One of them must be the league MVP. And I say that with all due respect to LeBron James, as more and more of the national writers continue to see LeBron James, see the Cavaliers lose when LeBron James is out and saying that is the most valuable. I'm going to continue to beat this drum until other people start beating it and kind of repeating it. And that is, MVP does not mean value. It means player of the year. Player of the year. And one of those two guys is the best player this year. Let's keep it in its perspective. No disrespect to the king out in Cleveland. That is going to do it. Appreciate you being a part of the conversation today. Tomorrow afternoon, we're back at it again at 3 o'clock for the next extravaganza. Stay where you are. Drive Time is coming up next right here on The Ticket.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep their trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.